You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer,
where writers and readers meet.
And story is everything.
And that was our opening music, Hot Texas, by the Hot Texas Swing Band. And we thank them for providing our opening and closing music with every show. And we're delighted that you are with us again for this special night. Who do we have with us tonight?
Oh, my goodness. We have Junie Fisher and Jesse Brown.
Oh, two writers and two good friends. And exactly. We're so delighted to have them with us. You want to introduce Jesse?
We have a nice introduction here. Jesse Brown, an Oklahoma native. She takes us down to earth look at life and can exist comfortably on the page with fictional characters she creates. A career in retail management across America gave her a life enriched by a variety of personalities and cultures. Since retirement in the Albuquerque, New Mexico area, these characters and stories have jumped from memory to the written page. She is a member of Southwest Writers, Oklahoma Writers Federation, and the Authors Guild. With a lifelong love of music, she has performed and taken leadership roles with music organizations such as International Western Music Association, Oklahoma City Traditional Music Association, and Southern California Bluegrass Association. Please welcome Jesse Brown.
Hi, Jesse. Yeah. We're delighted that you're joining us tonight so we can have some writer-to-writer conversation. And would you like to introduce Junie Fisher?
I would. I tell you, this is so much fun. And thank you for having me. And thank you especially when Junie's here. Junie and I have been friends for, you know, years, and she's been like a mentor through music with me, as well as now my writing as I become that, you know, emerging writer. Junie Fisher is a multi-award-winning singer, songwriter, and producer. The IWMA, or International Western Music Association, Entertainer of the Year, 4 times Female Performer of the Year with the IWMA and the Academy of Western Artists, 4 times Song of the Year winner with the IWMA and with Western Writers of America, and 2-time True West Magazine Best Solo Musician. She was the first woman to win the National Cowboy Museum's Wrangler Award in 2009 for her CD Gone for Colorado, which was also the 2009 IWMA Album of the Year. Her songs have been featured in film and documentary soundtracks and have been recorded by artists in folk and Western music circles. Before writing her first novel, Girls from Centro, she was published in Equus Magazine, Trout Unlimited Newsreel, The Western Way, and True West Magazine. Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, Junie.
Thank you for having me.
And tonight we're talking about, we have, you know, a matching pair.
We have a trio.
Bestseller right here.
You're the three.
Well, there you go.
Indelible link. And I think, Jinsy, you're going to start us off with a question.
As writers, the setting of a book can be so very important, and sometimes it even becomes a character in the book. But I wondered what your thought process was and your research in setting so much of it centered in New Orleans. And I think you did some research into a very historical horse racing place there also.
Yep. Well, New Orleans is it's a port town. It is a melting pot of people. Mm-hmm. The culture there is very rich in people of Creole and Cajun and all kinds of blends of people. And it is also, you know, because it's a port town, it's got a little seedy element.
Ah, yes.
And I needed that. I wanted that. And it's just a mysteriously good place. It's full of magic and voodoo is real. And I needed a horse racing center in order to give one of the characters a way to stay in trouble. And one of the oldest racetracks in the United States is Fairgrounds Racetrack on the outskirts of New Orleans. And it's a place where you go into Fairgrounds, but you don't go across the boulevard and go wander around in those neighborhoods. It's like most racetracks. It's not on the best part of town necessarily, but it's a cool place. And it's really an old place. And it's part of the Churchill Downs circuit.
Oh,
so they start the circuit at its time in the spring and they go then to Evangeline Downs and there's a couple others. And then they end up at Churchill Downs for the races that surround the Kentucky Derby at the end of the season. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The one that everyone knows.
The end of the spring season.
Yeah. You'll
see some of the same horses and trainers at their grounds that you'll see later, you know, six weeks later in Kentucky.
Okay.
Can I just jump in with a quick question? Because along with the setting, we also have two different time periods. We have 1944 and 1958. How did you choose those two time periods? And was it challenging to tell the story back and forth?
Well, I needed to do this in a time when I had World War II setup. And I also needed it in a time when a person of color who was of mixed race it's not as accepted as it is now. And it's not like it's that accepted now, even though we pretend, people do pretend, but I needed a time when that would still be could still be a different time for a young girl growing up being multiracial. And so I needed that time, but most of all, I needed World War II. I needed Pearl Harbor in particular. Mm-hmm. And I got the ship. You know, my husband is a war historian of sorts. And so I talked to him a lot about, you know, what happened here. And then I read the sequence of where would he be? Oh, he had to be on the first thing that got hit. And he had to be here. And I talked actually with a man, a veteran who was on that ship.
Great.
He says, oh, we just got our heads down. And tried
pretty
to
much.
Wow.
That's all they could do at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we all see movies and we go, oh, you know, the brave guy's going to win. That's not really how it was. It had nothing to do with being brave or being smart. It's just where you were standing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Lucky Eddie got lucky. Mm-hmm. Sort of.
Mm-hmm. Sort of. Mm-hmm.
And Lucky Eddie is very important to our main character. So you're right. You had to go there. Yeah.
Yeah. And being a port town, you know, that there you have the element of a ton of tattoo parlors and establishments and that element of those streets and what goes on those back streets and music and had to have the little elements of all of it. I can't think of another place where it would all be. So,
obviously, you know, centered in the circus and throughout the book, which is kind of interesting because you can't find a circus today. And
we're out there.
But how do you know so much about the circus?
Well, I spent some time with the Zilpe family circus. They are an Italian circus now in their 9 generations now of them. performing, and I learned to Rosenbach ride over a short period of time with a seventh generation Italian circus Rosenbach rider named Tosca Zoppé. Wildly beautiful and wildly good at what she does, and been doing it since she was 2 years old. And I got a really big view of what goes on behind the curtains in circus. It's, you know, it's not, it's like anything else. It all looks glamorous on the outside, mm-hmm. but the inner workings have an element of, you know, everybody's doing everybody's job, and there's always drama going on, and there's always things to be mm-hmm. fixed, and there's always things breaking down. There's always things going awry, and for a show to come off, it takes a lot of elements, and there's always changes going on in the script mm-hmm. of the show. So that taught me a lot about the mobility of a circus, and it's a fluid thing. It's not like the act is going to be this. Well, it would be until this clown trips, and then we have to, oh, somebody knows how to ad lib that, so mm-hmm. we fix that, or we throw this in, or we throw this song in here. Mm-hmm. And I learned a bit about the modern day language of circus, but then I needed to go back also and learn in historically at that time frame what kind of riggings were being used and what circus language would have been. You know, there's circuses traveled by train back then. They don't anymore. They travel by truck now. But back then, it was circuses happened in railroad towns. Mm-hmm. And you had to be mm-hmm. proximity to the railroad track. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I routed the their cross country.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And yes. I was on all of those tracks traveling in the, you know, around the United States in the southern part of the United States. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Fort Stockton, Texas had a big part in it. And I've driven by the little bar that's described where the two little women have a big time. And I mean, I've driven by all those places, and you can see by the train setup, yes, they could have set up a circus right here. And that's mm-hmm. what circuses did. They were very competitive with each other. And you might have mm-hmm. three or four different circuses going through a town in a year's time. It was very mm-hmm.
Did you find the competitiveness where they would try to steal acts one from the other? Was there
That is a very true thing. And in that, I saw that going on in the circus where I was spending a few days. I just, in talking with them, getting to know them, I learned, you know, that, oh, yeah, they're trying to get our, you know, guy here. And, and a lot of times they trade out because someone might be off the road for a while, and they make an act that needs a job for a part of a season. So the acts you see at the beginning of the season may not be the same as the end. You'll have to bait the core group, but the other acts are really added in, and sometimes they're local circus acts. Like right now in the Bay Area, there are several small local circus groups. So when a bigger circus, traveling family circus, mm-hmm. goes to those towns, they'll fill in with some of those acts that they know.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Huh. Yeah. Wow.
Anyway, it's a cool world. It's got its own code, and
You know, when I was growing up, which would have been in the 40s and 50s, you know, it was not unusual. Like our hero, our main character in this story, we always seemed to know some family that knew somebody that ran away to join a circus.
Yeah, glamorous. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it seems like a glamorous thing. And, you know, right. I was there in the thick of it and, you know, in a mechanic and learning that and seeing all the coolness and, you know, and how it all works. I thought, oh, I could do this. And then I had to go, this was 12 years ago. Junie, you're 53 years old. And you can't really actually do this. You're doing this right now, and you can make one lap around the ring without falling.
You could sell tickets and cotton candy.
Yeah, I get it.
Which is a job, you know. Exactly. Yeah. So it is there is always that element of running off with the circus, and then there's there was a song, well, it came from a song of mine called Sideshow Romance, about people that worked in Sideshow, mm-hmm. which was inspired by a song called Goodbye Cruel Circus, I'm Joining the World.
Yes.
About a guy who joins yes. the circus and falls in love with a trapeze flyer who's mm-hmm. a little bit, let's say that she just has a lot of boyfriends. And then one night knocks on the door of her trailer and there's some clown.
Whoa.
Literally.
Literally.
Yeah. Circling back to location and that type of thing. I, you know, as much as I love New Orleans, we know there is that seedy side.
Yeah.
And you talked about kind of a seedy side of horse racing, really.
Yeah.
And so did the circus just totally fit in there? And then the main character, Matilda, just, it was okay for a teenager to run off because it was like home. I mean,
well, you know, things were so good at home and, you know, things weren't so good at home. And she that just seemed like a thing. And all of a sudden there's this man who's paying positive attention and he's being nice to her.
Yes.
And this seems so much better than, you know, being at home where mom is gone and you got to take care of all your half siblings that your mom is home.
Yeah, it's quite a story. Yeah.
Time. And, you know, it just seems like better than whatever was there for her.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like, I don't know, a little adventure. And she was, you know, a kid that didn't fit in. And all of a sudden she fits.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden she's in her tribe.
She fits in her weirdness.
Mm-hmm. Her weirdness is what makes her fit, and her ability to just do whatever off the cuff. That's what saves her. She's got a little bit of that Fanny Bryce.
Yeah. Nothing fazed her. She was up for the challenge.
Yeah. Up for whatever. Okay. She screams. Okay. And then she ad libs. Yeah. And then they go, oh my God, she's Fanny Bryce. She's genius.
They just
played with that. She was
her wardrobe keeps I follow all the wardrobe changes here.
There was Bernice going, well, I got an idea. How would I do this?
Bring me back that leotard.
Yeah. And then they ask Bill, well, what do you think? He goes, yeah, she's gonna wear what she wants to wear anyway, and I don't have any control over that. And that's part of the fun for her, was to, you know, be just more just challenge it all the time. And you know, what if we shave? And you know, she just had all, and that was kind of what made it fun as she grew more confident. And the big fun part was that she had tattoos, and people didn't come to see a trapeze flyer. They came to see that girl with tattoos all over her.
Yeah. It's how they remembered her, number one. And then she was good at what she did.
She became better at what she did. And she was able to do the things, and she had some gracefulness.
Right.
But initially it was her kind of funny awkwardness and the tattoos that made her a sensation. So
tattooed lady. Yeah. Or girl at her age. Yeah.
A girl. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Eddie really broke the rules by tattooing a kid that young, but he had his reasons.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And do you think that immediately he saw something in her that was a need?
Yeah, I think so.
Fill?
Yeah. He you know, there was an immediate protectiveness because he knew who she came in there with.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd been in there before, and he ran her off because she was too young. And then he saw her show up again and didn't give her away. And he could have said, I've seen you here before, get on out of here, but he didn't. And he protected her from this boy that he knew was a bad boy.
Right.
And, you know, kept saying, don't look at him, look at me. And, you know, and made sure that, you know, he felt protective towards her.
Right.
And I needed that for Eddie. I needed Eddie to have some redemption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he felt protective of this girl because he knew who her mother was. Eddie was a frequenter at the track. He knew who her mother was. Everybody knew who her mother was.
Mm-hmm.
So he felt protective of this teenage girl in a very safe way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting because his, you know, his character, it was really rough, and he was, well, you know, he life was not good for him. So for him to be able to, you know, nurture somebody else and still be able to, it was mm-hmm. nice approach.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. It was that nice guy trying mm-hmm. to get out.
Yeah, I'm looking at her from going to other tattoo parlors where he said, don't you be going over there.
You'll not be taken care of as well. Yeah.
You know, fatherly or uncle-ly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or
yes. Brotherly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I liked his dad too. The dad that's deaf, yeah. Right, Sonny? I liked the two of them. I liked any scene that had as a reader, I liked the scenes that had them. Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, shall we, Jinsy, would you like to read the opening?
Certainly.
Because it's so powerful. So stay tuned. And here's a word from our good friend Richard Polinelli at Tuscany Bay Books. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Hey everybody, Richard Polinelli with Tuscany Bay Books, and if you're a reader looking for the next best adventure for your summertime reading or, you know, coming up on the winter, come to TuscanyBayBooks.com and check out our amazing bookshelf filled with books by some of the best authors out there in science fiction, fantasy, mystery thrillers, westerns, you name it. We've got something for you to read. And if you're an author who has just finished your manuscript and you're looking for a publisher, come to TuscanyBayBooks.com. Fill out our submission form. We'll take a look at it and we'll see if we can get you published and get you doing what you should be doing, which is writing your very next book. TuscanyBayBooks.com, that's your place to go if you're a reader or a writer. And now back to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. We're interviewing tonight Judy Fisher and Jinsy Brown.
And yeah, and this book, as I said in a Facebook post yesterday, readers, it will grab you from page one, word one, until the very last. And I think that Jinsy is going to share the opening paragraphs.
We all know, as writers, it's driven into us constantly that your book must grab the reader immediately, if not within the first chapter. I'm a 2 or 3 paragraph person myself. I've laid down many a book. But I think Judy has really shown us how to do it here. And then I have a specific question coming out of this. She sees the frayed cuffs of her husband's chambray shirt with eerie clarity as he jumps the boards into the ring, arms outstretched toward her, hands grasping at floating dust. But she can't make sense of the rush of colors that fly past her as she plummets through the circle of light. The music she had heard a fraction of a second before is now a whistling, crackling, assault of a sound. She clenches her fist tightly as if by miracle she'll feel the familiar heft of the trapeze bar. Instead, her nails dig into her palms. 15 feet from the tan bark, her arms jab involuntarily toward her face. The tattooed bluebird's wing on her wrist flashes past one eye. The scream she hears is her own. She's standing on her daddy's feet at the New Year's party on the dock in Baton Rouge. And he waltzes in comical sweeping steps to The Band Played On. He's singing to her. She's the girl with the strawberry curl in the song, he tells her. Mama is dancing with Grandpap. Grandmem's twirly blue silk dress floats around her slender calves as Grandmem holds someone's baby, swaying and swirling among the dancers. Then the music stops, and Daddy drops her on the dance floor, and she cries out to him. And now the music she hears is Stars and Stripes, and she's all alone with a mouthful of tan bark. Someone shouts, "Get that spotlight off! Jesus, get those people out of here! Oh God, I'm dead!" Parched eyelids shudder apart, and white light sears in. Oh, God, I'm not. That, I think, is one of the most powerful openings.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful. I agree.
That I've read.
Right.
And it has a lot of questions in it. Someone that has not read the book is just, oh, I've got to figure out what this means. I've got to follow that story. Mm. And I'm curious, Junie, as a writer on your process, when did these two paragraphs come about?
Late in the manuscript, because it took me many, many, many drafts to find an opener. Mm-hmm. There were just so many different ways I tried to get in the story, and I was so frustrated with it. How do I get in this? What is the reason for telling the story? How do I get in here? You know, and it took a long time. And then the Margaret Atwood advice about starting your story at the last possible moment, I go, well, wait a minute. And once I knew what was going to happen to Matilda, then I had a place where I could, well, I have a place where I could drop her in at the last possible moment. And that gave me a place to write. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Terrific. Do you normally write, I don't want to say chronologically, but do you just, scenes come to you and I've got to finish that?
Yeah, more or less.
This one comes.
Yeah, more or less. I might move them around, but mm-hmm. more or less, I sort of have a storyline. And as you know, sometimes I was going to go here, but now they want to go here.
Mm-hmm.
I did the same thing with my first novel, and I was tossing and turning one night. And my husband goes, "What is wrong?" I go, "I'm so worried about the girls." And he goes, "Girls?" I go, "Well, you know, Teresa and Luna and Salma." Because he goes, "Well, aren't you in charge of what happens to them?" I went, "Oh yeah,
maybe."
Yeah, maybe, maybe.
but yeah, I kind of have an idea, storyline wise, where I'm going to go. But sometimes, as you go, you go, oh, I could do this. And right. There was a lot of, oh, wait, I could try this. And then they would be trying something that didn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
There were probably, I don't know, 300,000 words.
And so, yes, I know things happen that affect that previous chapter or something, and you have to go back, but did you find an actual individual character changing as you went through?
Yeah, Eddie. I really had to play with Eddie a lot.
He did.
I wanted Eddie to, at first Eddie was, you know, just a seedy character.
Mm-hmm.
But I go, wait a minute, Eddie is a key here. And mm-hmm. I really needed him. And I had one editor that was helping me play with some ideas. And she goes, well, I don't know why you're so hooked on this Eddie character. Maybe you need to lose him. And I thought, well, he's here to lose you.
Right out the editor.
Yeah. I mean, she couldn't understand. She didn't know the whole thing. And so she didn't understand why I was so keen on Eddie being this big part of it. Well, because it's a multi-layered story.
Right.
Is not a story about just Matilda.
Mm-hmm. So
it is a story about redemption.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a story about addiction and choice.
Yeah, addiction.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that redemption, though, does need help from someone. And I think mm-hmm. that was Eddie for her.
For Matilda, it was Eddie. It absolutely was Eddie.
Yeah.
Yeah, he understood addiction as
absolutely.
Well as anyone. And there were others around him that didn't make it, as we saw.
Sure, you know? Sure.
As is usual. That's the usual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have a great question about Eddie. Or Bobby, we are at a break, or are we okay here?
Or should we take the break and hold that question? What do you think?
Let's break and then I'll come
back.
All
right. So, hold your horses, everyone, because there's a great question coming, and let's take a little listen to Out West Shop.
Okay.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods, We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer on LA Talk Radio. And by the way, when you shop at OutWestShop.com, use coupon code RADIO. It's pretty simple to remember. And save $10 off a purchase of $75 or more. And we are back with our guest authors, Jincy Brown and Junie Fisher. And I think Jincy's got a great question we're waiting for.
Well, we've broached the subject of Eddie here and how important he is to Matilda, our main character. And we've admitted that Eddie had flaws. That's who he was. And there is a character in this book, while maybe short-lived, I thought was very impactful. Mm-hmm. And with his addiction came the usual monkey on his back. Which I thought played right into the circus in some way. We think of monkeys in the circus. But I wondered how on earth you got in the mind of that little monkey and wrote some of the stuff that you said.
Yeah, that's a great question. Readers want to know. Oh, my gosh.
Nasty little critters, you know. Yeah. Right? Oh, darling. And, you know, Little Whiplash, the rodeo monkey, he just loves riding his dog. No, he doesn't.
Yeah.
So, most horrible little beast you've ever seen. We've all, most of us have heard the term monkey on your back. So it just made it just, let's just make it a monkey. Mm-hmm. And it's just a horrible little critter. And in my mind, the voice sounds like you'd think it would.
Come on, Eddie, you and me have some fun.
You know, it's just a horrible vulgar little creature and it rides him all the time.
Yeah.
Wasn't hard.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would just totally have to get into Eddie's mind as well as the monkey's mind at the same time. What would really get Eddie, you know, and have the monkey say that and so forth and so on. But he was quite a little demon.
Oh, yeah. Which quite an important addiction is. Addiction is, if you let it become so, it is that. And it does, you know, but Eddie was always, there was always an element of Eddie that was trying to swat it away.
Uh-huh.
So, and I had to have that for me, because I had to have read Eddie have, I had could not let Eddie go full blown to the bottom of the barrel. And maybe he did get there. You know, he was questioned about that. He was close, maybe. Yeah. But he was still functional. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly worked in bands with functional alcoholics and addicts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they still know how to go out and do the job. Right. And Eddie still was doing, to him, he was still doing good work, but he wasn't a good human, but he was still doing good work. And so I needed Eddie to have that little bit of humanity left where he wanted to swat that away when it came time to make that decision to get help.
Right.
He sort of his eyes and did it.
Yeah. And as we've talked about before, that I felt like that Matilda needed him and he knew that.
Yeah.
And people like that gave him the strength to go ahead and make the decisions he needed to make.
I think so. I think also growing up with a father who was deaf and who is not necessarily a fit in society, that also probably gave Eddie some more compassion toward humanity. Mm-hmm. Thinking back on it, I don't know if I did that on purpose, but I wanted Eddie to have, you know, sure, he's rough and he's a little, you know, tough and always got a cigarette hanging outside his mouth.
Yeah.
But he still had this, you know, this element of being kind to his dad and,
So, you know, He's the type of guy that would have signed up after Pearl Harbor, you know. Right. He had a good streak in him. So
he had a good streak in him somewhere.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there. And it came through.
Right.
I thought it was interesting that Matilda kept in correspondence with him over all the years, because there's a long time before they see each other.
You know, that was a long time that she really didn't have, you know, her best friend in high school betrayed her.
Right. Yeah.
She and the other girls teased her for being, you know, what she was, and her best friend betrayed her. And I think that's when she needed a friend. And so her way of having a friend was to take her $5.
Yeah.
Down to the tattoo parlor.
And get a tattoo.
And get tattooed. Yeah. And then somebody's touching her.
Yeah.
There's an element of touch in tattoo. It's not sexual by any means.
Right.
There's an element of touch. And there's an element of, you know, a little bit of, there's an endorphin rush, even though there is pain. And for her, that was the human contact that maybe she craved.
Uh-huh.
That, in my mind, that she craved that contact. And that somebody talked to her.
Mm-hmm.
And then Eddie'd ask her how she is doing. Who, hey, how'd you get that bruise? Oh, I fell. Mm-hmm. Oh, the hell you did.
Yeah. Right.
Don't you let those girls treat you like, you know, I that was her friend. That was the only friend she had.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, so, back then, tattoos really were unusual, you know. Today, everybody has one, it seems like.
Yeah. Well, in that culture, everybody had them too. But
yeah, we are
more used to seeing it now. But everybody,
yeah.
In that cult, not everybody, but it was a very common thing. I have an uncle who served in World War II, and every time he stopped at a port,
you get that too, right?
He got a new tattoo. He was covered with them. I don't know if he got them all intentionally. But
well, soberly, yeah.
Soberly.
Yeah. Who knows?
But. Yeah, there certainly was that element of that, and certainly in the military. And then when he gives her the speech about why people do that, he says, you know, guy, why is he getting, because he can't, you know, he's getting shipped off, or his girlfriend broke up with him, you know, but they all just want to remember the pain instead of letting go of it. And he called to the head on her hanging on to what hurts instead of crying and getting over it and
move on.
So
which he did.
But the circus part was fun too.
Going back to the circus family, did you find them just the kids just naturally thinking this is what they were going to do? Or their work parents saying, I don't want you doing this?
No, there's no doubt that's what they do. Parents want they start their children very, very young. Mm-hmm. That when they're 2 years, you know, year and a half, 2 years old, they're in the show.
Yeah.
Little clown costume. They throw them in the show. Some of them keep them back for a few years, but eventually if they're traveling, they're going to be in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of made a comment about little Matilda's son, Billy, be better off in the show than out back with the clowns.
Because
that's a bunch of vulgar little monkeys back there sometimes.
Wow.
And the roustabouts, you know, they're sort of a lot of times transient guys.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They hire at one town and get off the train at the next. And
There was a scene where the whole circus group goes in Santa Barbara. They go down to the ocean. Was that date? Was there?
I don't know, what has become the Earl Warren Fairgrounds there is set up. It could have happened. Could go across an overpass and go down from there. So I just in my mind I made it at that place where the Earl Warren Fairgrounds is now, and that they could go across that overpass.
It was such a great scene.
From there, it take a little bit, but they could do it. So I had to put it there, and I had to have that happen there so that they could. So that Gloria Fiscalini, the sister who used to be a flyer, could come and visit. Mm-hmm. Now, Gloria Fiscalini is a real person. And she's a very dear friend of mine who lives in Cambria, California, married a rancher there.
Okay.
And so I told her, by the way, Gloria, you're in my book. And she goes, well, let me be a wuss. I go, no, you're a trapeze flyer. You're retired. And very elegant and beautiful. I love that. I had to put it in Santa Barbara, but there's all the places where I really went into detail about the circus, those are places where I know what the layout looks like. And it's not that I described the layout, but I could make it happen in those places.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We've all seen a bus stop and train station.
Yeah.
In your process, you've obviously done a lot of research here. And then you just mentioned that you made stuff up. How important is it, do you think, to mention actual places, actual restaurants, actual and how much is too much, you know?
Well, it becomes too much if you start explaining and describing too much, I think. We can, not everybody knows every place, but if you're talking about a real place and there are really people that are there, you do have to make it where they go, no, that's not how that's set up.
Yeah.
Because you're going to lose the people from that area. You know, you're going to say, you know, sometimes you read things about, I don't know, I've read things like, no, that's not how it's done.
Right.
And so I did use actual places like the setup at Santa Barbara. Yeah, that's a possibility that could have happened. Mm-hmm. In Tulare, California, there's a fairgrounds there. That's where I grew up going to the fair. And I could set it up there and then go on to Fresno. And that's where the family, you know, caught up with them. And I know those places. So I could, it doesn't mean that I described them, but I could see them. And it's very possible the way the routing would happen. That's what was important. Was finding old railroad maps from the 40s.
Oh, yeah.
And making sure I had the routing right. You can't write a story where somebody goes, wait a minute, trains didn't go in there until 1972. Right. You know, so you had to, find the old maps and find out where the routing would have taken them.
Right.
And they're trying to hit the smaller towns where the bigger circuses haven't been, where, you know, Barnum and Bailey and Vargas and those big circuses haven't already been there and taken up everybody's money. You got to go where people still have some money to spend. And so they would hit those smaller towns, Fort Stockton, Texas, Katy, Texas, those smaller towns. And then down in Benson, Arizona. Then at the racetrack at Santa Anita, that would be a really typical place to stop off, you know, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And gives Rosa a chance to pick up another horse that didn't work out, but
I guess she would have to. So Matilda did get tattoos other places other than she had to, because this was years.
Yeah, she did because she was out on the road, and then, you know, she did tell Eddie, "Oh yeah, I got these other tattoos, but you know, you'll see." You'll see. And then sometimes people recognize Eddie's work.
Mm-hmm. That was interesting.
His work. Right. And then, and then there was one tattoo she got that was a bad one. And Eddie said, you know, you want me to fix this? This is crap. You know, why would I fix this? It just makes it hurt. And that was a key part, was that it was not only a bad tattoo, it was like, why'd you do this? You know? Mm-hmm. And that was a key one for me, was to, like, she got that tattoo to never forget that pain. Mm-hmm. And Eddie said, well, that's a bunch of crap to do that. That's terrible.
Yeah. Did you have a comment?
Well, I don't know if I'm ahead of the game. I did have a question. You know, you commented the other night when we chatted. You had an interesting way that you got sold this manuscript.
Uh-huh.
You know?
I pitched it around for about a year.
Yeah.
And I was tweaking it as I went. It was pretty much in the form that it is, but I was tweaking a few things as I went and tweaking my query letter. And I remembered that there was a publisher who had, their CEO had read Girls from Centro, my first novel. And she had sent me a note and said, gosh, if you ever have another manuscript, we'd love to have a chance at it. And so after I kind of went through agents that didn't get it, they didn't understand what my query was about. And I'm just not into that. It's a really nice query letter. It sounds like an interesting story, but not something we can sell. You have to learn to not take that personally. Mm-hmm. And it's okay. It's just not something they can sell. It's not that you're a bad person, personal attack. So, I decided, well, I'm going to go ahead then and start pitching to some small publishing houses, some mid-sized publishing houses. And I wasn't going to go back to my first publisher. So I wrote this. I went on the website of this other publisher, Bedazzled Inc., and I saw that they were not accepting manuscripts, submissions at that time. So I wrote a note to the CEO and I said, oh, I wanted to let you know that I have a new manuscript and I just went on the website and I see that you're not accepting manuscripts, but I'd love to know when you are. And I'd love to send my query letter to you. And she said, she wrote back in, you know, 10 minutes and said, oh, consider this your invitation to send a query and send you me your query and your synopsis. Well, I had a synopsis ready because I'd had it ready for an agent. And so I sent those and she wrote back in about 20 minutes and said, we'd like the full manuscript. And I thought, well, they're okay. I'll let them have that for a month or 6 weeks. I'm going to keep pitching. And she wrote me the next morning and said, I stayed up all night and read this and we want this. And I said, I played it cool. I said, okay, well, yeah, send me a contract. Let me take a look. And we played with the contract a little bit, but they've been terrific to work with. And they're very attentive to things. And it was a nice step up for me. And they've been terrific, just terrific to work with. And we really didn't change anything or move anything around. We just did a little tidying up. So.
Junie, what's the best money that you've ever spent on your literary career? We get to see it. We get to see it.
Yay! A tattoo, so that I knew how to write about what that sensation of your first tattoo is. The other good money spent the subscription to Microsoft Word, what I use to write, and it's a very simple platform, and most editors use that. There are others that are very good. But that's a really universally known one. And another one is the Authors Guild.
Yes.
Because you can get, they have a legal team. So if you have a contract question, I've sent contracts to them and said, can you go over this? And they make suggestions. I would suggest this, or actually this looks pretty clean. And with this editor, I was so delighted. I said, okay, well, I'm going to, nothing personal, but I'm going to send that to Authors Guild. And they go, oh, no, please do. We often use whatever their new suggestions are, we use those to adjust our contracts. So that was money well spent. And I do participate in their forums and kind of pay attention to what's going on in that. But getting a tattoo.
This has been delightful. I'm the timekeeper and I'm kind of watching that clock. And we had so many more things that we wanted to talk about. So Junie, we're gonna have to look at 2023 and have you back.
We'll do that.
Jinsy, you just launched a website and Facebook page yesterday. Yes. Congratulations. Yes. And where can people go to find you?
The website is, I'm so simple, jinsybrown.com.
Yay!
Yay!
And if you have trouble with the first name, I always tell people my name is on every important door in town. Emergency exit.
That's right.
That's how that's spelled. And then I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, though I haven't done anything there yet, but the others I have. So I'm out there, and I do have a blog that I've started on that website. So, and I call it the Little Brown Cottage, Little Brown Cabin, I think it was.
Yeah, Little Brown Cabin.
And so we'll just talk occasionally. I'm not committed to any specific schedule, but we'll talk writing and we'll talk fishing and we'll talk whatever's happening at the cabin that week, And keep it fresh.
And Junie, where can our listeners find you?
JunieFisher.com. Keep it simple. And of course, my books are also available on Amazon. They're also both now available through Bedazzled Inc. because Bedazzled asked if they could pick up Girls from Centro. And so I said, yes. So they picked that up and re-released it. And Bedazzled Inc., Amazon. You can also get them through Barnes and Noble or your local bookseller. Just go in and ask for it by name and they can get it because they're all available through Ingram.
And, well, we thank you both. We have a parting quote, as we always do, writing advice from author Margaret Atwood. You become a writer by writing. There is no other way. So do it. Do it more. Do it again. Do it better. Fail. Fail better. Until we meet again next week with our guest. Next week will be E. Joe Brown. We know him as Joe Brown, and we'll be discussing his new book, A Cowboy's Destiny. Till we meet again next week. Good. It's always a great day.
Hey, out west.
Out west.
You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.